Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for October 22nd. DNA pioneer Jim Watson is the subject of much of our show today, but probably not for the reason you or we expected. He's been raising hackles by making comments on race and genetics. We'll bring you the full story. Plus, a week of fertility stories distilled down to their essence, courtesy of science correspondent Ian Sample. And the biggest vegetarian that ever existed. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Welcome, everyone. Here in the pod this week, looking serious, it's science correspondent James Randerson. How are you, James?
I'm very well. It's a very serious business.
We'll be hearing more about your shenanigans a bit later. Back from a very long sabbatical on the high seas, it's Nell Bowes.
It's lovely to be back.
Good to see you. And here is our special guest, geneticist Armand Leroy from Imperial College. Welcome, Armand.
Hello.
And pressing the buttons this week is producer Matt Hayward. Well, we'll kick off with James Watson. The DNA pioneer was here in London this week to launch his new book, Avoid Boring People. But things took an unexpected turn after he gave an interview to a Sunday newspaper. Here's Nell with the story.
James Watson is no stranger to controversy, but even he claims to be mortified over the race row that engulfed him as soon as he arrived in the UK. A row that has left a cancelled lecture tour and a damaged scientific reputation in its wake. The problem started with a story in the Independent newspaper on Wednesday. Apparently, Watson had made comments to a Sunday newspaper a few days earlier, in which he seemed to suggest that black people are less intelligent than white people. Numerous scientists and public figures condemned the comments as both scientifically illiterate and damaging to race relations. Later that day, the Science Museum announced that it would cancel his lecture. It said his comments went beyond the point of acceptable debate. At his book launch on Thursday night at the Royal Society, Watson tried to backtrack. He apologised unreservedly for the inference that many had drawn from his words, but he didn't clarify his views on the subject. The final straw came later that night when Bristol's Festival Ideas also pulled his scheduled lecture. Writing in The Independent, Watson admitted he understood the reaction to his comments. "For if I said what I was quoted as saying, then I can only admit that I am bewildered by it. To those who have drawn the inference from my words that Africa as a continent is somehow genetically inferior, I can only apologise unreservedly. That is not what I meant. More importantly, from my point of view, there is no scientific basis for such a belief. I have always fiercely defended the position that we should base our view of the world on the state of our knowledge, on fact, and not on what we would like it to be. The overwhelming desire of society today is to assume that equal powers of reason are a universal heritage of humanity. It may well be, but simply wanting this to be the case is not enough. This is not science. To question this is not to give in to racism."
Well, we have an interview with James Watson, and here it is. Okay, well, we were supposed to have that interview, but James, why don't you explain what happened?
Well, I'm starting to feel like some kind of high-class rent boy hanging about in expensive London hotels. I've now twice been refused an interview with James Watson at the last minute. And on Friday morning, I was informed very helpfully by text message that he had decided to leave the country altogether and was in the process cancelling his entire lecture tour and numerous other engagements.
He had a book launch at the Royal Society as well. Armand, let me bring you into this. You were at the book launch as well. Can you tell me what the atmosphere was like? This is after a few days of relentless media coverage of this issue.
It was, I thought, a desperately sad occasion. Here we have one of the scientific giants of our age. And let's not take any credit away from him. Not only was he a brilliant young scientist, but he's also one of the great scientific organizers of our age. He's a man who's known everything, known everyone. And yet here, launching what may be his last book, and it's a delightful book too, 30 people came out of a country in which he knows everybody. To be sure, there was a Nobel Prize laureate or two, a handful of media scientists, and a bunch of journos trying to get to him past those brutal bouncers. And yet he was a very solitary figure.
I mean, James Watson sells out lecture theatres. He could probably sell out arenas with his lectures. I mean, he's a popular man. But let's look at the issue that's at stake here, the idea that genetics would have something to say about intelligence. Armand, what do we know, if anything, about the things that link those two factors, intelligence and genetics?
Well, we certainly know that intelligence, or more narrowly measured IQ, and let's not get into the question of whether IQ actually estimates intelligence, but you can measure IQ, and we certainly know that it has a strongly heritable component. There's an abundant amount of evidence for that. The question is, what are the genes? And the answer is, well, we really don't know. And that's almost certainly because there are many genes involved, and they're rather rare, and you need really big studies in order to find them.
Is anyone doing anything like this?
There are people who are trying, but there hasn't been a great deal of success.
And you can imagine why there aren't that many people trying, because I think most people would agree that the comments that were in the Sunday Times, I mean, if indeed they're accurate and he said them, come across as pretty ham-fisted and offensive. But the problem, I think, is that if anyone touches on this issue, it is liable to go off in their hand in the way that this week has for James Watson.
Is the nuanced way, if you like, to say this, that there are going to be genetic differences? If you're living in a different group, then you're likely to evolve differently. I mean, is that an accepted scientific position?
Yes, of course. I mean, in some ways, it's trivially true. People in different parts of the world look different from each other. Nobody disputes that. The question is, what's happening inside of those heads? And that's where things get a lot more complicated. The classical position is that there are no differences between people in different parts of the world. That is probably something that is going to eventually unravel as we learn more and more about the genetic basis of behavior and intelligence and emotions and so on.
Nell, you got a question?
I was going to say, is that default position that there is no difference, a sort of an ethical standpoint or moral standpoint that you take because there's a problem with relating difference to value judgments? So you talked about the fact that people look slightly different and there's less of a value judgment there and saying they have different levels of intelligence.
Yes. You have to put it in its historical perspective. Before the Second World War, anthropology, genetics, was founded very much on the notion of differences between races. Indeed, it's practically one of the founding principles of anthropology, which goes right back to Linnaeus in the 18th century. It was one of the major tasks of reconstructing these sciences after the Second World War, for obvious reasons that they should be cleansed of any notion that there are such differences. And yet, in the last 50 years, that is, of course, hardened into dogma, and like any dogma, there will always be people who question it. And of course, the temptation to ask those questions becomes overwhelming now that we actually, technically, for the first time in history, have the power to answer them.
I mean, we are finding differences. Some people are susceptible to diabetes and some people aren't. Some people are susceptible to breast cancer and some people aren't. These differences are in individual genes and even individual mutations in the genetic code. But as we look for all these differences, are we just likely to find that everyone's more similar than everyone actually thought?
It's all in the residuals. It's absolutely clear that we are all strikingly similar to each other. There are fewer differences between an African and a Japanese than there are between two races of Drosophila melanogaster, the common fruit fly. But we always tend to focus upon that last unexplained residuum, that last little piece that we don't know anything about. And it's clear that some of those differences do matter. So, for example, it's long been known that African Americans have a higher rate of hypertensive heart disease than European Americans, and that has been traditionally attributed to the gross socioeconomic differences, indeed directly to the effects of racism, and very plausibly too. But not entirely. The new studies are showing that there's at least some genetic component. Two genes have been identified that are at a higher frequency in African Americans and that are a consequence of their history that is found in Africa and that contribute towards that difference.
I suppose the big question for those people who are uncomfortable with the argument that there are differences between races is that even though there may be a difference, that may be true on the average, but you can't necessarily say that about the individual person.
James, why don't you go through some of the reactions people have had to James Watson's words this week?
Yeah, for example, the London mayor, Ken Livingstone, for example, said, these views are not welcome in a city like London. David Lammy, who's a a government minister said, you know, it's a shame that a man with a record of scientific distinction such as this should see his work overshadowed by his own irrational prejudices. Generally, people have come out saying, you just can't say this kind of thing, Jim. Although some scientists have been a little bit more nuanced about it and said, you know, come on, let's have the debate. It's a real shame that the Science Museum, because they were the first ones to cancel his lecture, it's a shame that they did that, because, you know, it would have been better to have a robust questioner there saying, you know, but what about this, what about that, and let the audience have their say as well and, you know, tease out the issue.
But Armand, let me give you the last word at this point. You mentioned at the beginning, and we know this, that Watson is one of the great scientific titans of the 20th century. In this particular case, was he just talking outside his specialism?
I think that's true. I think what we have to do is to think of it as, shall we say, a speculation. And it seems like an irresponsible sort of speculation, but you have to remember that is what scientists do. Our lives are devoted to the play of the intellect. Our business is to question. And sometimes, when a thought pops into our head, we don't always control it before it emerges from our mouths. And I think something like that happened here.
Well, more on all of that a bit later in the show. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we've got the biggest vegetarian that ever existed, plus the latest fertility news from across the pond. Just in case you haven't had quite enough of James Watson yet, he's mentioned in our Science Extra this week too. In the third and final conversation with leading biologist Craig Venter, The Guardian's Ed Pilkington discusses the genome wars, Venter's race against the scientific establishment to sequence the human genome.
There was a real fear, I think, because the billions of dollars that were going into the Genome Project was the first massive funding for any single project in science.
And so the stakes were very high.
The stakes were very high, and the view was anybody that threatened that, either because they were against the project. I mean, I was on multiple committees with Watson in the early stage where, you know, he would get into these nastiest verbal fights with people because they just intellectually opposed the Genome Project.
Right. You know,
he and I were on the same side then, but any enemy of the project for whatever reason, you become my enemy.
Craig Venter there. The full interview is this week's Science Extra, which you can download on iTunes or at guardian.co.uk/science. Now, of course, it's time for a roundup of the other science and tech news that's been going on this week. Here's your News Jam.
News Jam.
The United Kingdom is planning to claim sovereign rights over a vast area of the remote seabed off Antarctica. The submission to the United Nations covers more than 1 million square kilometres of seabed and is likely to signal a quickening of the race for territory around the South Pole.
An influential inquiry into the future of Britain's abortion laws began last week amid controversy over an apparent attempt by faith-based organisations to skew the balance of evidence presented to the Committee of MPs. At least 8 submissions of written evidence have come from medical professionals who have not disclosed their membership of Christian groups opposed to abortion on faith grounds.
Scientists have grown genetically modified poplar trees that are able to remove pollution from the soil. The experimental plants, which contain a gene from rabbits, were capable of removing up to 91% of a chemical degreaser from the water used in their feed.
And finally, it was 4 stories tall, had a neck 10 times longer than a giraffe's, and was possibly history's biggest vegetarian. Meet Futalognacosaurus duckii. Discovered on the shores of Lake Borealis in Argentina, the gentle giant lived 80 million years ago.
Nell and James, thank you both very much. James, can you say the name of that dinosaur again?
Easy. Futalognacosaurus.
Excellent. On a more serious note, last week the Science and Tech Committee of the House of Commons did a sort of short inquiry about the scientific knowledge that we've gained since the last update to the Abortion Act. Can you take us through it, James? What evidence were they hearing and what was at stake?
Well, what they've tried to do here is to separate out what we know scientifically about various aspects of abortion and the moral and ethical debate that surrounds that, if you like. And so they very specifically ask for just scientific evidence. So, I mean, that's caused a lot of controversy in itself. But the sort of questions that they're looking at are, for example, the issue of the 24-week limit, the oldest gestational age at which most abortions can happen. Now, the evidence there is about whether babies younger than that are able to survive if they're born at that age. But also there are other questions as well about, is it the case that women who undergo abortions are more likely to have mental health problems afterwards, you know, feelings of guilt which may go even further into sort of suicidal thoughts, and whether the future pregnancies of those women are also in worse shape.
Where's the science pointing on some of these things? I mean, the 24-week limit is a particularly sort of sensitive topic. Are fetuses able to survive through new technology? I mean, has that must have moved on?
Well, it was a little bit bewildering listening to the evidence session on Monday night, because some people were saying there have been improvements and others were saying no, there haven't been any improvements. I mean, the issue here seems to be whether you talk about individual clinics or whether you look in the round at the whole lot. I mean, it's certainly the case that some clinics do quite well, but really the sort of survival rates that you're talking about are really low, sort of 20%, that kind of thing. And even those that do survive, a lot of them have a very poor quality of life because they're severely handicapped. There's one big study called the Epicure 2 study, which some of the results are starting to come in from that. And some of the evidence that was heard on Monday, it seems that survival rates actually haven't gone up.
Okay, well, there's more than 300 pages of evidence submitted to the inquiry, and you can see all of that on the Parliament's website. And there's also an interesting discussion going on about this, thanks to James, on the Science blog. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. Now for something a bit different. Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample was in Washington, D.C. last week at the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. A raft of kind of weird and wonderful stories came out of the meeting, everything from a new type of genetics-based contraceptive to how to keep sperm healthy. Here's Ian talking to Andrew LaBarbera, scientific director of the ASRM, about why women shouldn't freeze their eggs to use in future.
Egg freezing has been a big deal this year, and the association has come out and said basically egg freezing shouldn't be offered to career women who are looking to extend their fertile life just for social reasons. Is that something that you agree with?
Well, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine is looking at two aspects of this problem, one of which is the technical aspect. Right now, the process for cryopreserving oocytes is quite inefficient and not very successful. The techniques for freezing eggs are not well developed. There are many people that are working on this, and ASRM certainly encourages continued research, but we also have not developed highly reliable techniques for thawing them, and the success rates have really not been very good. So we don't think it's ethical for companies to be marketing this procedure to people. On the other hand, the ASRM feels that it could be reasonable for women, for example, who have to undergo cancer treatment, who have no other option. But then there's also the issue, completely separate from that, of whether it is ethical for women to plan in advance to postpone their reproductive process and have the eggs in storage. That's something that really needs to be further examined by society for purely social or convenience reasons.
Mm. So for women who are about to have chemotherapy, they have their eggs frozen, then they can use them after chemotherapy. The issue of egg freezing, certainly for social reasons by women, I think that's not been something which has become a big issue over in the UK yet. But it sounds as if in the US there are companies that actively market this service for career women who basically haven't found Mr. Right yet.
There are indeed companies that are doing this, and the ASRM really has a problem with that.
Does anyone have any numbers of women who are paying for these services?
There are really very few published data. there are groups that are doing research on this and are publishing their statistics, and that's how we know that the procedure is not very successful. However, the groups that are marketing this procedure to couples, we only know about them because many of them seek to exhibit at our annual meeting.
In Sample, they're talking to Andrew LaBarbera of the ASRM. All of his stories from the fertility conference are at guardian.co.uk/science. Before we get back to talking more about James Watson and his comments, here's a slightly related story. As part of Black History Month, Caroline Bressy, a historian at University College London, spoke at the Science Museum's Dana Centre recently on the issue of racism in science. James met her and asked her about a famous challenge to the 19th century science establishment.
There's one example of the English anthropologist James Hunt, who delivered a paper on the physical characteristics of the Negro in 1863 at the British Association in Newcastle, and he was quite openly racist, really. The kind of typical things that you might expect from scientific racism.
What sort of characteristics was he talking about?
The size of people's heads, the length of people's ankles, the size of the arch of their foot, the fact that supposedly Negroes couldn't stand upright, that they were closer to apes than they were to Europeans, those kinds of racialized stereotypes that we associate with that extreme racism, although for him it was purely scientific. But while he was giving his paper in Newcastle, there was a man called William Craft, who was an escaped African-American slave who had come over with his wife Ellen, and actually they ran an import-export business in the 1850s. But he traveled to Newcastle to counter the arguments. He sort of said, well, look at the diversity of Africans themselves, if you go to the continent, which he had done. He had gone to Sierra Leone. He was like, you know, you can see a whole diversity of people. He was just like, you know, if you go down to the south of England, you can see quite a lot of the agricultural labourers can't stand up straight. You know, that's just not something inherent to sort of Africans. But I think his point was also, it was about social construction. So it's not the fact that he was inherently more stupid, but that where he was from in America as a slave, he wasn't given the opportunities.
And how did those arguments go down?
Not very well. He had used the example of a young woman called Sarah Forbes Bonetta, who had come to London as a young girl in the 1850s. She had been sort of enslaved. She had, you know, been an orphan. It looked like she had nothing going for her, but she had become a goddaughter of Queen Victoria. She had got great education in there. She could speak various languages. She was a great musician. But Hunt retorted that, you know, no, that's not science. That's philanthropy. And anyway, you're not a real African because you've got European blood flowing in your veins, so it's not surprising that you're able to be relatively intelligent.
How did things change? Because, you know, say Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin, was famously into eugenics and had some quite dodgy ideas right into the next century. How long were these sort of really extreme kind of racist ideas still bandied about?
Casual ideas that came through. So the fact that Africans were lazy, I think sort of environmental racism probably still lingers, maybe. And those kinds of ideas became part of popular education. So if you look at geography textbooks, the fact that Negroes liked shiny things and they liked to dance, which is probably a stereotype most people would recognise today, that gets put into textbooks for people that are taking the Cambridge Certificate in Geography.
To what extent now is science sort of pervaded by those kind of ideas? I mean, obviously, the sort of outright racism that you're talking about with Hunt is virtually non-existent and would never be published in scientific journals, I think, these days. But there may be more subtle things going on.
Well, I think what's interesting is this idea that race is becoming legitimated through ideas of genetics. The scientific argument now being, well, actually, there might be genetic reasons for racial difference, and out of that coming things like you might market particular drugs at particular groups of people. I'm not a scientist or a geneticist, but I think the problem is that racial difference always has come with prejudice, and I don't think, you know, there's any reason to think that that won't change. So I think, you know, that's something that raises alarm bells. And I think there are always people, say, for example, mixed race people, that always blur those boundaries. I think I'd probably still be far more inclined to say that there are impacts on people that the colour of their skin relates to issues of poverty and social class and those kinds of things rather than inherent racial differences.
Caroline Bressy there, who was speaking before the furore broke last week. Bloggers have been having their say on James Watson as well. Talk to the Hand says On Comment is free.
It's hard now not to infer, and no, I don't have solid scientific proof, that East and North Africans on average are better suited to middle distance running than Scandinavians, or that West Africans are better suited to sprinting. There was a time when it was considered racist to say that blacks make good sprinters. It was an oversimplification, both in terms of the particular racial origins of good sprinters and in the idea that a statement about average performances could be applied to every individual. But there was a kernel of truth.
Moose One argues,
a better approach, I feel, would have been to let him speak and then demolish his ideas via evidence and argument, rather than simple censorship, which will only fuel the fires of those who claim the ubiquitous PC Brigade are claiming another scalp.
The interestingly named The Trash Heap says,
letting political correctness into science is like letting religion influence science. Wrong. Science should supply and deal with only facts or reason logic. It is up to us as moral beings what we do with that information.
Armand, let's bring you back in. Is this a case of political correctness negatively affecting the debate?
Well, let's be clear that politics has always been in here. It is the vexed issue of population genetics. It's always the elephant in the room. And the thing that we always seek is a science without politics. If it's ever obtainable, I don't know. And I think the Watson imbroglio just tells us that it ain't happening yet.
But there's lots of science with ethical impacts, political impacts, and so on. And is it fair to allow scientists to just go off and do whatever they want?
Well, let's deal first of all with the specifics of this particular case. Watson was talking without any evidence, so let's be clear on that. I appreciate, as a working scientist in the United Kingdom, that we have to respect the laws of the nation that we work in and the sensibilities of the taxpayers who fund our research. And yet, you know, I am always haunted by the thought that had Vesalius, the founder of anatomy in the Renaissance, not defied the mob, the church, and the state, and dug up those corpses and cut them open, we wouldn't have human anatomy. Sometimes scientists do have to defy the societies, even the laws which they are subject to.
I was just wondering, when you say that scientists should be able to defy those laws and think freely, in this particular situation it seems to be about more than free thought. On Comment is Free, Sue Blackmore says, if a great scientist cannot speak the truth as he sees it based on evidence, even if that opinion is unpalatable, then something is horribly wrong and science is under threat. The implication there is that James Watson, as a great scientist, has a right to pronounce on this and that he has the evidence there, which I'm not sure is entirely merited.
I don't think the important point is actually that he's a great scientist. If one of the lessons that comes out of this is that we shouldn't necessarily listen to Nobel Prize winners just because they're Nobel Prize winners. And let's not forget that it wasn't too long ago that Carrie Mullis, inventor of the polymerase chain reaction and Nobel laureate for chemistry, was denying the fact that HIV causes AIDS. His wacky ideas, they really had consequences because people believed them, did not take antiretrovirals, and people died.
So why is it wrong for the Science Museum to deny people a platform if they're going to be propagating irresponsible ideas?
The way to deal with unpalatable ideas is to argue against them, and that's what the Science Museum should be doing, and that's what journalists should be doing as well, at least good science journalists. The question is, are you actually doing it?
Well, that's it. the uncomfortable questions come back this way.
Armon, last word to you. How's the world going to look on this in 5 years' time? Are we going to forget about it all? Is James Watson going to come out with his scientific reputation unscathed, really?
Yeah, absolutely. We will remember that brilliant young man who unraveled the structure of DNA, that arrogance, that wit, that irrepressible intellect. We'll remember the man who built Cold Spring Harbor, one of the great laboratories in the world. We'll remember the man who kick-started the Human Genome Project. And we may remember some of his more outrageous sayings, but in the same way that we'll remember, oh, the Duke of Edinburgh's. Maybe we'll make a little book about it.
All right, well, we'll leave that there. Well, that's it for this week. My thanks, of course, to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, Nell Bowes, and our special guest, Armand Leroy, whose book, by the way, Mutants, is still available in great bookshops. Don't forget that you can listen to the third and final part of our series of conversations with Craig Venter as this week's Science Extra. Science Weekly was produced this week by Matt Hayward, and I've been Alok Jha. See you next time.
Guardian Unlimited.